Welcome to the Weekend Sports Cars on the Marshall Pruitt Podcast, presented by Cooper Tires. I believe I hear the sounds of a well-rested, well-deserved, well-rested Graham Goodwin. How are you, my friend?
The bits that show are slightly more tan than they were. Nice week in our second home, the fantastic Isle of Cyprus, where Trudy and I married some 14 years ago. But nice to be back. Pleased to be back. Pleased to hear your voice. I know it's been a very, very tough week for you. If listeners to the Week in Sports Cars haven't caught up with the last edition of the Week in IndyCars, you may not know. Marshall is a good lady. I've had some troubling news. I'll fill in here, MP, because I'm sure this is a difficult one for you to deal with. I know you had to cut short what sounded like a joyful trip to the Rensport reunion at Laguna Seca after news that your beloved lady had fallen victim to breast cancer. And I know you're dealing with that very actively right now, the pair of you. You know that you've got our best wishes, my family's best wishes. I'm absolutely certain everybody here's best wishes for carrying that forward, and a huge amount of support I know from people around the industry after they heard the news too.
Yeah, thank you, brother. Just honestly trying to create as much normalcy as possible, and this being a situation where it's my wife and I looking after one another, we don't really have parents or family nearby to fill in that role. It's the two of us, and that's a great thing. It just means that going forward, once I got that news, I think it was last Wednesday, and then off to Rensport Thursday morning, just trying to roll with that, and had to cancel all travel, so no Petit Le Mans for me, which I hate that because I love that event so much, and obviously IMSA is a huge part of my life. Fortunately, was able to sit down with IMSA President Scott Atherton last weekend in Monterey, and Scott and I have known each other for a really long time and have a pretty good personal relationship as well, and was able to tell him that unfortunately I'd have to miss Petit, but obviously for well understood reasons, and in typical Scott fashion and IMSA fashion, they only cared about the personal side, not the work or business side, and cast their full support, offering anything needed. So it's been a humbling thing. And just in the amount of support from all the folks that I work with closely at Racer Road and Track and such, I've almost lost track of the amount of folks from IndyCar that have reached out, drivers, officials, you name it, same on the sports car side. So it's not as if something like this, Graham, is meant to be any kind of state of the union, but when something like this happens, you find out the kind hearts that are out there, and just blown away, absolutely blown away by the messages of support and offers of help in any area throughout our little universe of motor racing. So I don't want to belabor the point. We're obviously here to talk about sports cars, something that you and I love. And hey, we even do a little podcast dedicated to it. But
do we?
Thank you. And thank you to everybody. And this is going up on Thursday, a day later than usual, sometimes 2 days later than when it normally goes up. And that's the only thing I'll ask for understanding in advance. I don't know exactly what our schedule is going to be like for the rest of the year. Surgery is coming up soon. Then it's going to be chemo or radiation or both, you name it. And so, I am, in American parlance, the quarterback here. And so that'll mean that my number one priority is obviously my wife. And so could that push a podcast a day late or two? Well, it's already happened, so very possible. And but thank you to everyone in advance, not only for all the kind, incredibly kind notes and messages and love and warmth, but also understanding that some of my normal routine will have to be adjusted because of the number one priority that has visited us for the rest of the year. So with that said, why don't we start talking about sports cars? And we're going to try something, I don't know if it's new, Graham, because we continually flirt and tweak with...
We do.
Well, you and I continually flirt and tweak. Mm-mm. But then when it comes to the podcast, we also flirt and tweak with adjustments. We're going to try something a little bit different here. Nothing outrageously different, but our man Goodwin, for the past probably 2 months, has been jumping in, grabbing all of your questions, and collating them, organizing them by subject or series. And what we've done is bounce around a little bit, going from WEC, IMSA, ELMS, SRO, GT3 stuff, your fun questions, funny questions, whatever it is. Try to bounce around, sample a little bit from each in rotation throughout the show. We're going to try something a little different, be a little bit more linear, and start off with a couple of questions that were asked by many, many people that we've consolidated into something we can jump into right away. And then after that, I think we're just going to try, maybe we'll go with ACO and WEC type world, go through all those, then jump to probably IMSA right after that, go through all those, and then after that, probably SRO. And there was another note from a listener. It was actually for the Week in IndyCar podcast. He said, hey, is there a way to, in your episode notes, to drop in something that says, hey, at 42 minutes and 15 seconds, we shift to this major topic. Week in IndyCar doesn't quite work that way right now, but at least for what we're doing here with the Week in Sports Cars podcast, Graham, I think we can indeed, you know, once we're done here and I get everything produced and posted, I should be able to drop notes saying, hey, if you're more interested in the IMSA than the this or the ACO, start here. So anyways.
Train whistle at 33 minutes, postman knocked at 42.
Listen to that the kind squeaky of chair at this point because it means we moved.
No squeaky chair. Well, squeaky chair.
Mine's been squeaking, so
see, has it?
We're a team. We fill in one another's.
You need my new oil sponsor, don't you? That's what you need.
All right. Where, my dear friend, shall we start among the most asked questions?
Well, it leads us neatly into an event that you went to and I didn't. And for that, I am a little bit jealous. Ren Sport reunion at Laguna Seca looked absolutely astonishing again. Tell us a little bit about the event, but while we're doing that, MP, you've also seen the car that has piqued the interest of, amongst others, David Faulkner, Rob Chalmers, Sean Romig, asking about the astounding looking 935. It's a derivative of, you know, in the loosest possible fashion, the GT2, the astonishing turbo powered road car that's been made in track only form. 77 versions, I believe, to be built of this thing. One of them has been testing at Monza this week. There's video and imagery on the web, but you've seen the first one presented publicly. Tell us a little about the event and tell us a little bit about what you know about that car.
So here is further confirmation of how daft I am, Graham, and I hope you're going to enjoy this. The reason that I, after getting the news, still went to Rennsport for 2 days instead of four is have a Racer Magazine feature project that involved interviewing 10 current and past Porsche factory drivers and or key personnel, and so had to get down there to do that. It was a bit of a rushed crash process. So over my 2 days, I'm just running in and out of the media center because Norbert Singer is available for 5 minutes here. Go run and get him. Hurley Haywood, Vic Elford. Hey, I just spotted Earl Bamber, or whom, you know, it's a lot of, some things were planned. Some of them were total kind of kamikaze commando style. I think I see so-and-so off in the distance. Off I'm going. One of those was helped by our friend Aaron Ketchel, who looks after Core Autosport and the Porsche GT team in IMSA. And I did need Lawrence for one of those 10 interviews. And she's like, hey, he's available now for a couple minutes. Can you pop by? Great. Jumped up from the media center, started storming over towards Lawrence, who is at the Porsche Motorsports North America support truck. And as I'm walking to Lawrence, I see it had to be a throng of people 10 deep on one car. And it was enough to where I couldn't see the car. But clearly something special was going on. Now, I would not proclaim to be a Porsche-phile, but I do have a significant passion for Porsches, but not to the point of knowing whether the lug nut on the 1973 911 SC, if that's even the right year model number, is correct or not. So
we'll
not,
get mail. We'll
right,
get mail.
I know we will. But admittedly, I think most of the folks who turn up for Rennsport are those people. And so when I saw, you know, this proverbial 10 deep throng of folks surrounding a car, I knew it was something special, but I didn't know if it was a Singer edition model or if it, I didn't know what it was. I just knew it was special. Like, all right, cool. But regardless, I had to go see Lawrence Vanthoor. So I just kept rocking. And so I'm standing there talking to Lawrence and interviewing him. I'm kind of peeking over with my right eye to see, and it's getting to be 12, 15 deep. And however things shifted, Graham, I finally caught a glimpse of some white and some day glow reddish orange, whatever that exact color is, and figured, oh, well, it looks modern-ish from the glimpses I can see. So finally, when I was walking back and the crowd had maybe fallen down to 7 deep, I could see that it was the brand new, oh my goodness, best thing ever, 935. And so looking at it, listening to it, watching it move, I was so glad that it remained turbo. Looked just incredible. The long tail, boy, the visuals are just stunning. And I would say that of all the things that Porsche got right with it, it was understanding that without the Moby Dick style dramatic overhang at the rear, low drag, long tail version, they couldn't really extend the nose too much. But I would just say, looking at it, for those who've seen the cars at the original 935s it was based on, boy, they really hit the mark on this one. And this comes back to David's question and David Faulkner, Rob Chalmers, and Sean Romig, all who've asked in some way, shape, or form, do you think we could get that new car to race under either ACO's upcoming GT2 regulations, then SRO's new GT2, which I think is what David meant.
That's what he meant, I think, yep.
And then we also had Sean saying, hey, the incredible 2019 935 in the SRO's upcoming GT2 class, ? No surprise, everybody wants to see this thing race. I want to see it race. We did see that Bozzy 19 video of an all-carbon 935 pounding around Monza. Boy, I wouldn't be pounding around Monza in an all-carbon, racy kind of Porsche if there weren't bigger intentions, Graham. Does that sound about right?
It does. I think the answer here is it's a little bit like the McLaren F1 back in the period, isn't it? Which was never designed as a race car. It was a road car. It was the demand from those cars' owners that drove the racing program for the F1. And it may very well be that that's at least in part what happens with a car like this. GT2, which, to remind listeners, is between GT4 and GT3, just to be really complicated. So effectively, be likely very much more powerful than a couple current GT3, but would have less advanced aero, which this doesn't quite fit, because the potential is for this to be particularly aero efficient. But I think there's a might element of it. Is there a definite will be element of it? No. I think what they're they're looking towards for GT2 is something is very much more road car like, maybe a little bit extreme road car like, but road car like, and certainly not something that looks quite as swoopy as this. We know that Porsche, I believe Lamborghini, possibly McLaren too, are the likely first exponents of GT2 regulations. I am hearing that things are a little delayed in terms of getting these things rolling. I've spoken to one championship organizer that whilst it's been mentioned they might actually have GT2 opportunities next season, the likelihood is there might not be room for them because the demand is pretty high. But look, who doesn't like the prospects of a long established sports car brand looking to their heritage and doing something sympathetic with it? I reserve judgment on it because, you know, I'll be honest with you, one or two of the publicity pictures that have come out, I don't think particularly did it justice. I think it's one of those things that you have to actually see in the carbon fibre, as it were, to get the best out of it. But let's hope we do see it racing. There has actually been one other sort of tribute towards that. That's Kramer Racing in VLN, who produced a kit for the Porsche Cup car that had that same kind of swoopy look, MP, which did look very good. I did see that one in the car, but it did look very good. Proportions were very slightly off, but didn't make too much of a difference with it looking, you know, the more than a nod that it did to heritage. I like it. Why wouldn't you like it? Am I someone who absolutely is head over heels in love with it? Not yet.
Well, I just had the Bengals come to mind with head over heels, so thank you for that reference very early in the show. I think my wife and I also saw that video recently, so sorry that fell into my head. We've got, let's see, 1, 2, 3, 4 questions on Ginetta. You are our resident Ginetta expert. I believe you have a placard that you proudly sport in your office that says Ginetta expert. So that is your...
I have literally got the t-shirt.
Disciple of Tomlinson 2.0.
That's scary.
Graham Goodwin. Yes. All yours, mate.
Well, there's a couple of points being made here. One is about LMP3 and whether or not Ginetta will be back in the next rules iteration. The other three questions here from the likes of David Fortner again. Right turn lover, our good mate from Switzerland, Dr. Daniel and Tom Bacon, asking around the LMP1 project. LMP3, let's get that one out of the way very quickly. LMP3, we already know who the four chassis manufacturers have been selected for the next round, which will be from 2020. That will be the return of four existing chassis suppliers. Ginetta is certainly on that list, so they have bid for it. They will be given that opportunity to produce a new car. It will be based on the same chassis. Our understanding is there will be a revised engine. There will be marginally revised aero package, and there will be new safety regulations, including the internal side impact bar that exists at the moment, LMP1 and LMP2. So yes, I expect Ginetta to be back and marketing LMP3 cars. As for the remaining questions, pretty predictably, with the confirmation that the Ginetta AER entered by TRSM Racing will not be making the trip to Fuji for commercial reasons. The question is really about where does this leave Ginetta? Let's make this very clear. It has not been Ginetta's choice that the car is not going to race in Fuji. They are not the entrant for this car. They did certainly very substantially contribute to the second car being able to race at Le Mans 24 Hours, the 5 car. In this instance, the issues appear to be between various elements within the TRSM team, whether or not that's part of the manor operation, whether or not that's the management, whatever it is to do with whether or not the right amount of money has transferred between those elements of the entrance that has cost them the opportunity of taking the car to Fuji. Does that mean the end of this program? That's a matter for TRSM. So that's a matter for TRSM, and the entrance, the official entrance was TRSM Racing, but in the person of Graham Loudon. I've not caught up with Graham in the last week or two. But clearly, things have not been going particularly well between the various elements with that entrance. As for Ginetta, they effectively are powerless here. They cannot enter the car themselves. They are not the entrance for the WEC. And uniquely in WEC, you cannot enter as a single entrance a race-by-race car in LMP1. You can add a second car for the odd race here and there, or even a third if you're already a two-car entrance. But you cannot come in and just enter a single LMP1 car in a one-off race. The regulations specifically prevent that. Where does this leave the program? That's a very good question. And I think the answer there is we don't yet know. I'd like to think that TRSM can get through their current woes and that they would be, I hope, now targeting their home race at Shanghai in November. Clearly, with the super season and fewer races, that means there's more time between some of those races. But if they miss Shanghai, then of course the next opportunity, it's going to be Sebring and it's going to be March. So at least that gives them time. But does it give them the sustainability for the program? That we're only going to know that answer, I'm afraid, when the crates get unpacked and the containers arrive, or indeed the cars are actually air freighted in. And I hope we do see the Ginetta racing. I think it's a project that deserves that opportunity to prove itself. But the one thing I'd say in terms of one or two of the questions have been around, one or two of the posts that have been around, this isn't down to the manufacturer. This is down to the team. They are the entrant. They make the ground as to who and what goes where and what money is spent. The issue here for Ginetta is they need a more solid program. I know they hope that TRSM can provide that, but if they don't, then the reality here is without a change in regulations, their hands are tied.
I think we're going to end up staying with you, Graham, for our next line of major questions that we have lumped together before we dive into series or sanctioning body specific questions. And I'll also readily admit that beyond reading some of what was put together by yourself and others, this is certainly an area that is not one I should be speaking on because my brain isn't filled with knowledge. That is Audi, hydrogen, Le Mans, the possibility of getting the four rings back in 2022. We have questions that have come in from Mark Atkins, Stephen Gate, and Jordan Hopwood that are certainly deserving of some good Winnie knowledge and explanation.
Well, let's get spool back here. For those that didn't see the story, we were re-reporting a story from Le Monde Libre, which is the local regional newspaper and online news source for the Sarthe region. This is the region where, obviously, around Le Mans. Now, with that in mind, you can sort of guess that perhaps there was, how can we put this, a leak.
A hydrogen leak, yes.
Well, that's potentially really bad. You would guess some contact from Audi around the potential 2024 regulations. And, you know, to this point, we've been talking about BMW pushing for this zero emissions rule set. But this adds potential real interest, doesn't it? Around, you know, if you've got the mountainous, you know, OEMs that are BMW and Audi interested in that. And both apparently also interested in maybe an earlier opportunity to demonstrate that technology, perhaps with Garage 56, perhaps with something else, that potentially what we've got here is we're going to close in on effectively the end of year deadline for the 2020 regulations, that we might actually be starting to get excited maybe a little earlier than we thought we might about the next phase of this. All sorts of questions, you're quite right. You know, from a number of people dropping questions in, asking what we heard from our sources, not a lot at this point. Jordan Hopwood asking if we could ever see a Garage 56 entry that's good enough and fast enough to challenge the overall win. That should not be the point for Garage 56. Garage 56 operates outside the rule set. Generally speaking, that the potential for those cars to compete for a win is not the point that should be being made there. And my guess is that if you were to ask the technical team, they'd certainly be actively interested in these cars getting to the finish. Only one car ever has in Garage 56, and that was the unbelievable effort of Fred Sauce and the SLT 41 crew that brought the astounding achievements of a man who's a quadruple amputee being a firm part of bringing an LMP2 spec car to the end. But I hope we do see it coming. Zero emissions is clearly going to be a thing moving forward. The ACO, and for that matter the FIA, are looking what they can do to leapfrog out of what has been a bit of a blind alley in regulations, and it's taking some time to get there. But I hope there's truth in this one. We know how good Audi have been. We know how good BMW are in a range of technology-led activities. And, you know, a new battleground with, you know, what I think most industry observers certainly agree is one of the likely next big leaps in automotive technology would be the right kind of thing to have at the Le Mans 24 Hours, whereas at the moment they're struggling actually for that commercial USP linked with technology, which is where we've got a lot of this kind of criticism about the reliance on hybrid, which I think some people would actually imply might be a kind of a technology that's beginning to lose its relevance as EV, and then in this instance zero emissions technology starts to come more to the fore. So what have we heard in terms of detail? Not a lot. Do we expect to hear very much more? Only if I can get a senior executive at Audi drunk, which is unlikely, because I'm going to get a lot more drunk than they are a lot more quickly. But I think this is real food for thought. Saw the story, saw who'd written it, saw who'd been involved in it. It's credible. They're not making this up. This is not a kind of snowstorm. People are talking, and if they're talking in the terms of the timelines that we're talking here, which is some kind of presence by 2022, maybe not with a hydrogen car, hydrogen fuel car in by 2024. The reality is they need to be talking in some detail right now. What would I expect to see next? I'd expect to see, if this is this is right, Audi, or certainly VAG Group, involved in those technical groups to develop the next set of regulations and those beyond, because it will be important for them to preserve the kind of framework that they will want to fit the templates of the kind of outline plan that I'm sure they've already got, MP.
Indeed. You know, since we're just coming off of some ACO-ish type goodness or potential goodness, why don't we kick off actually with our thematic questions with IMSA, so we don't just go from ACO to ACO.
Works for me.
And I will grab one or two here, starting with Zacchaeus Lok Kung Liang, who I hopefully I just murdered all of that from start to finish. I apologize. Can Scott Atherton still change his mind on P2 regulations? I think, Graham, that would be in reference to IMSA deciding to split its DPI and P2s into separate classes. Do you think that might be the question?
When I read the question, that was exactly what I took from it. So it's pertinent to the kind of couple of stories written in the last couple of weeks, isn't it?
Yeah, I'm sure he could change his mind, but I'm fairly confident they are far enough down the road on establishing both classes as independent things that we will not be seeing that happen. I think that they are set to do this. There's no going back. And from what Graham has written and DailySportsCar.com has posted very recently, it would appear that there's been a surprising interest in Pro-Am LMP2 cars being on grid. I think it might look like an Areca 07 spec class almost, if we're talking across the full season next year. But yeah, if this is something where the split ended up killing P2, then I would certainly say that IMSA would need to reverse course. Sounds like that's not the case, and if anything, we could have a higher subscription. I thought we might be staring at 2 to 3 cars at most next year, full season. Who knows what that's going to prove to be? Maybe that's all it will be. But at least early indicators is that number could be almost double. So that is something where I think Atherton and company would not look to make any changes on the what's coming here for 2019. Next question, Mr. Goodwin, comes in from Kyle Hall, who says, what are the odds of a Dallara LMP2 participating in an IMSA race this year? Well, we got one more to go, Kyle, if we're talking actual big championship race. Also, any Bill Riley or Multimatic news, is the LMP2 Riley dead? I know you've been plugged in on the Dallara side pretty heavily, Graham. What have you heard? Anyone from ELMS looking to parachute in, maybe, or ACO LMP2?
I think there's potential for a Dallara to be seen at the Rolex 24. There's potential to be it for a car, or possibly more than one car to be seen there. We've had this this kind of subtext, if you like, of teams that have got a solidly pro-am business model, not a super silver, but pro-am business model at LMP2, being quite attracted by the prospect of being able to compete for a solid class win at the big races. So that might have an impact on some of the teams coming over. And with a later start to the European season, no prologue test, remember, for the WEC guys this year, actually having the cars in the USA earlier in the year might have some interest there. There are equally a little bit of disquiet about the balance between the chassis. That's still around. It's a very sensitive indeed. But the reality is that I think conversations are underway about just how is it you stop this moving towards a single chassis class, because the dominance in very many cases of the Orica platform is becoming a bit problematic. That, okay, we did see a win for United Autosports with their first of the season in the rain-shortened Spa LMS race. Their first race, by the way, shifting to Michelin tyres, which bodes well for what's going to be happening at IMSA next year. But there's a lot of disquiet around whether or not that is something that can be maintained without either some form of, first mention, balance of performance, or another go-around, if you like, with the Joker process, which effectively allowed the other chassis manufacturers an opportunity to try to play catch-up. The wrinkle with the second option, by the way, is to do that, it would require all four chassis manufacturers to agree, and there is zero chance of Orica agreeing unless they themselves would be allowed to make changes to the 07. And of course, with the cousin that is the Rebellion R13, that would give them an opportunity to learn any lessons they've learned with their LMP1 aero program and put that into an LMP2 program. It's not an easy one for the rulemakers, but equally well, beginning to get rumblings of some dissatisfaction with some of the non-Orica teams. Should be said as well, by the way, you've got the most recent change in IMSA for the Ligier team just having shifted to an Orica, and with the
PR1 AFS Matheson.
Absolutely.
AFS PR1 Matheson, PR Matheson AFS1, I think. Pick
absolutely.
It's in there.
Beautifully put.
I got a lovely email from one of the drivers on that team.
I bet you did.
This morning, by the way. We can talk about that if you want a little after this.
Guess which one as well.
Yeah.
But the interesting thing there was talking to senior team source not that long ago. We were talking about the choice of the Ligier, and the answer there was very direct, which was, if we were going to make a change, and we might, we wouldn't be looking to an Orica. We'd be looking towards a Dallara. They went and bought an Orica.
Yeah, and on the Kyle, on the Multimatic LMP2 side, I can't speak for any other team. Who knows if someone would want to take the the chassis that Bar One ran at the 24 Hours of Daytona early this year and try and bring that back. I mean, again, who knows what folks conjure up in their brains, but I would say that since there has not been any development of the P2 chassis since that race, which carried a lot of the updates that were also featured on the Mazda RT24P, which is based on that car, we've seen the Mazda grow and gain and, really become highly, highly competitive as a DPI. there's just been no, you know, no, really no running of that Riley Multimatic Mark 30 in P2 form. So unless I'm a team with very few dollars and just trying to get into the race knowing that I have no chance, but I'm doing it on a super low buck effort, I couldn't see that happening. It's just, we've seen the Eureka just become the LMP2 version of Kudzu. It's just overgrown all the other LMP2s in IMSA in terms of competitiveness. After the Lige, which has just been mollywopped by the Eureka, you would then have the Dallara as a third option, or I'm sorry, as a second option after the Lige. And then after that, you'd get to the Riley. So a good effort, or good intentions. See, the DPI is working quite well. But yeah, really, I could not fathom anybody who would turn up with that car just due to the lack of on-track running and development since January. Let's go to Kevin Kemp, who says, with Mazda announcing the return of the Wankel engine, thank you, Mazda, this means good things in the universe, as part of a hybrid system, could we see it in one of the Mazda prototypes when hybrid technology is introduced to DPI? Haven't asked that question, Kevin, and I will make a point of doing that next time I do speak with Mazda. I'm quite interested to see where Mazda's mindset will take them when the next generation DPI regulations come through, Graham, because we know that with its 2-liter 4-cylinder AER turbo, they've gotten to a place where I believe it's kind of maxed out power-wise. If it had to, you know, squeak out another 50 to 100 horsepower, I think that would be, it would be problematic. Curious to see what their mindset will be when the next gen regulations come down, and whether it is, we're going to stay with a small displacement 4-cylinder turbo, but maybe 2.2, 2.4 liters, since it's truly a bespoke engine, unlike some of the GT3-based or production-based DPI power plants. This is something that they made from scratch with AER. So we'll see what happens. I think they're going to go to something bigger and more robust, but if they were actually to go back to a Wankel, if they were to go to a rotor, I mean, I'd be the happiest. I'd be the deafest guy in the world, but I'd be the happiest too, because I'd just stick my head right next to the exhaust and run around the track following the thing.
Well, it's worth mentioning, by the way, if you haven't seen this news, that what it's actually about is it's a part of Mazda's electrification policy that comes into play in around 2020 with versions of cars that will be fully electric, and also version of what may well be the same platforms with a range extending engine, traditionally fueled engine, and that the idea would be that you would be talking about a very small capacity Wankel engine, rotary engine, for that range extending technology. So interesting times and interesting options as well, and I'm sure both the engineering and, for that matter, the marketing side at Mazda, and they are two arms of the company that have worked very well together in the past, will be putting their corporate heads together to see what might come out of that one. Interesting.
Getting down to the last couple of IMSA questions here, my friend. We'll go to Tom Welfi, who says, beginning of the year, Dyson Racing said they had a major sports car announcement and nothing materialized. Have heard a few rumors of their return. What have you gents heard, if anything? Tom, I don't know a lot, but a part of me wonders if this was the announcement from Chris Dyson with his CD Racing that he would be competing in both Trans Am and his own short track midget, is a dirt racing oval program as well. That did branch out and has become a much bigger portion of Chris's fun and activities this year. So not saying that's the answer to your question, but I wonder if that's what they had intended, because since their Bentley Pirelli World Challenge Series effort wound down a couple of years ago, really the only sports car involvement I can think of would be Chris's participation and active participation in Trans Am this year. So wonder if that's it. And next time I speak with Chris, I'll try to remember and ask. And of our two remaining IMSA questions, Graham, do you want to take the one here from Cookie Monster FL? So I think the answer might be we're going to learn more in a week at Petit Le Mans.
I think you're right, Cookie Monster, one of our guys listening from Reddit. Hi there, guys. Quick question. When will we get full details of the Michelin Encore in early November at Sebring? Do you guys know any teams that are planning to compete in the four-hour race? Got to assume we'll get to other entrants at our IMSA or PWC Stalwarts, or am I too starry-eyed? I think the answer is you are likely to see full season entrants, and maybe you might get a bit of indication of maybe some people looking for an early opportunity to join the party that otherwise might be first seen in the pre-season testing. But in terms of format, I think that will develop very much along the lines that it'll respond to the entrants they actually get. I think it's a very smart prospect, because the teams, the opportunity to get out there and play in real time with the black round stuff that they're going to be pulling in competition for the 2019 season. I think it's a great opportunity for Michelin as well to test the logistics that they've got, both in terms of the logistics getting things to the circuit and the on-site support, which will be taking a massive step up in IMSA for Michelin for 2019. So in every single way, I think this is a very good news event. Just what support they're going to get from the paddock, I think you're absolutely right, MP. I think there'd be a lot more to be said from Road Atlanta in, about 10 days' time as we record this, this podcast, by which time I'll be across in Fuji. And you'll be watching, as you were saying a little earlier, from distance. But I'm sure you'll be burning the cell phone mileage.
Yeah, absolutely. It's just going to be strange. And there's, and I'm not saying this in any real, like, oh my goodness, the sky's falling. But there's just a lot of changes. A lot of things that I'd like to be there to see and say farewell to. Obviously, Tequila Patron is ending its time in the sport. We have Continental bidding farewell, Michelin coming in as a full-time effort there on the Continental tire side. The Street Tuner class is conducting its final race. There could be a driver or two that are bidding farewell to their careers, who are planning to retire, blah, blah, blah. So, yeah, hate that I'll miss it, but it is certainly not my number one priority right now. I will mention, and maybe I'll throw out a request for questions here. I meant to speak with our pal Dear Alan McNish on Saturday to do a podcast reflecting 10 years back at his greatest drive that I've seen, that being his return from crashing on the parade lap at Petit Le Mans 2008 to the fight back to
Paris. No, he's done better than that for that lap, mate. I've seen better laps than that.
True. He has crashed. He has better crashes than that. I was at Le Mans for one of them. But maybe I'll ask folks for some questions about that, because we're just honestly going to do a 10-year look-back podcast about that amazing drive where not only did he win, but he also killed Christian Kleen's career as well in doing so. We'll be looking back at that and having a little bit of fun. Let's go to the final IMSA question coming in from Down Under, from Carl Hartley. Greetings from New Zealand. Hello, Carl. My question is regarding the Lola P1 Dyson racing car that they ran once or twice in the ALMS back in 2013 with the Bolton hybrid unit installed. Could you share some insight into what that system was? It didn't seem too competitive at the time, but is this what we could expect to see in future regs, i.e. a spec type of unit that will bolt into any existing chassis? Thanks, GG and MP, for all your awesome work. Kind of you to say, Carl. That was a flybrid mechanical system. And I remember seeing it and I think writing about it at the time. I think it might have been 2012. Not sure if it was 2013, but regardless.
It was 12.
Okay, one main thing, Carl, which I would say on the topic of you're recalling that it wasn't super competitive. If we're looking back 6 years now on hybrid technology, it's only 6 years, but it's... almost caveman times by comparison to the advancements that we have now. Back then, it featured two things that were disproportionate to what you would want for competitiveness. It was heavy, and it did not generate a huge punch in terms of power being sent to the drivetrain. And the fact that this was a mechanical flywheel system that spun at something like 50 or 60,000 revolutions to then store that energy and then, boom, release it. I forget exactly how much it weighed. I'd have to look back at what I wrote, but it was something in the range of 70 to 80 pounds. That's a lot of weight. If we're talking about a car that, you know, comes in at a little over 900 kilos, although I guess 70 to 80 pounds might not sound too crazy, you throw an extra 35, 40 kilos at a vehicle like that, and you would need to be generating, you know, 200 horsepower or something to compensate for that weight. And so I think this was a great concept, which they tried. And I believe if there was additional funding, they would have carried it forward, looked at what weight reductions that could have been done and such. But the reality is it was something new they wanted to try. As I recall, it fit in the bell housing of the car. And so you have most prototypes that are already rear heavy, and then you throw an extra 70 to 80 pounds in the back of the car, and that itself is going to pose some handling deficiencies, plus just the inertia that you have to deal with getting up to speed, slowing it, the extra force and consumption of tires. Yeah, great idea, something they definitely wanted to try out, but the weight to actual power benefits simply were not there. And from
I can give you the numbers, MP, if you like. The numbers were, when you took into account not just the flybridge system itself, but also the gearbox that was needed for the set effects of the second power source, it was 88 pounds, 40 kilos, and produced 134 brake horsepower, 100 kilowatts for up to 5 seconds during every braking maneuver.
Yeah, so that's
not enough.
Yeah, exactly. So that, I believe, rounds up our IMSA goodness. You want to walk us into the world of ACO?
We'll kick off actually with another newsy story, and it's Right Turn Lover again, hello, comes in with Ducci Drive. Also have the option to take their appeal case forward, or have we heard the last of the Le Mans 24 Hours 2018 results? I damn well hope so. You know, we are in a situation where G-Drive Racing actually knew that they would be going to the 2019 Le Mans 24 Hours by dint of winning the LMS. Some days before, they knew whether or not they'd officially finished the 2018 race. That's ridiculous. And it is part of the kind of process, and that's not down to the teams involved. But I've not heard anything from TDS Racing and G-Drive Racing since the result was confirmed by the FI Court of Appeal, which means that Signetis Alpine take the win, and another win for Alpine. That will finally, I hope, put a full stop into the paragraph that lists the 2018 Le Mans 24 Hours results. I am sure that now, you know, we've had that conversation, we can have slightly more in-depth discussions with those concerned at TDS Racing. I know what they're going to tell me. They're going to tell me that they felt that the regulations were worded in such a way that it left the opportunity for them to do what they did, which was to introduce an element into the fueling rig that effectively defeated that fuel filler, fuel restrictor. But ultimately, the big-brained legal eagles have decided that they were wrong and the rule makers are right. I'm sure we're going to hear opinions that they was robbed. But that's it done, and I hope we can draw a line underneath it. So that's that one. One from someone cunningly called the S's. Will LMP2 see a transition to the two-seater mold, similar to what's anticipated for hypercar, P1 car, blah, 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 for the LMP1 replacement? Says it's going to look a bit odd to have cars that look like road-going hypercars racing alongside single-seater Le Mans prototypes. They're not really single. It's kind of seat and a half, isn't it? I get the point that we're talking here around the opportunity to have things that look a little bit more like a road going hypercar, but it's going to be a prototype. The key to it here is that they're designed to do two very different things. LMP1 is designed specifically in the new era to appeal to the OEMs, whether or not it's the big white goods producers, if you like, or the more bespoke sports car and hypercar producers. LMP2 will remain as a pro-am formula in the ACO world, and for that matter in IMSA moving forward, and don't therefore need to have that relevance. Whether or not there's any pressure from the entrants, and it would be the entrants rather than the chassis suppliers that actually makes that point clear, but remember this, the introduction, the retention of Alpine as both an homologated version of the Orica and indeed as the tagline for the Cittatech Alpine team has produced no little controversy, because you're not supposed to have auto manufacturers involved in LMP2. I don't see there being a reason for a change, and I guess you'd have to look at the success where the new LMP2 regulations have been introduced. In terms of the numbers coming forward, there's nothing that needs to be mended there. You've got a formula that is proving to be successful, and I think can be pretty long-lived as well. Next one up is one from, let's have a quick look, Diamond Matt, with an apparent bug for F1 drivers doing Le Mans over the past years. Do you think it might become a more regular occurrence in future years? With the unknown 2020 onwards regulations, if reported brands in talks come to the WEC, could this be even more attractive, wanting to compete amongst other teams and drivers? MP, what do you think? I mean, you work in a marketplace where we've seen a lot of this, particularly the Rolex 24 is a great example of introducing that kind of star-studded grid into a one-off race, albeit very often within a wider championship, just exactly the same in the modern era as the Le Mans 24 Hours is. What do you think? If the factories are coming, are they going to want their biggest names?
I think they'd want their biggest names. I might even take this in a slightly different direction, and because it's the value that stands out most to me, and it's that looking at what Patricio Ward learned and was capable of using all that he gained in IMSA's PC class to then come in back to Indy Lights, win that championship with ease, qualify fifth for his first IndyCar race, finish ninth. Looking at what the regard in which a Colin Brown is held with immense sports car experience we now have, and I know this to be true because I've spoken with a team owner, one IndyCar team owner that is very keen on utilizing his services next year. Same is true of Felipe Nasr, who is in talks right now to hopefully do something fun in IndyCar. I look at how, at least from an open wheel side and maybe just a general finishing side, mate, that folks are looking at, boy, sports car time, sports car, you name it, that is really, really something that is of value and is going to either expedite the experience of someone and or just build layers of knowledge within them that they might not have elsewhere. So I know it's maybe a little bit of a lateral way of answering the question, but could I see manufacturers trying to stack talent to bring them in and really play things up and have these monster staggering lineups for the Rolex 24 and maybe Sebring as well? Sure. But I would also say I believe there's a shifting recognition that beyond star power, we can send Lando Norris over here. We can grab Phil Hansen. We can pick a lot of the younger drivers as well who we think are going to be stars. And I think folks are starting to realize that, hey, 24 hours of experience, 12 hours of experience, whatever it is, these are just things that are going to benefit those manufacturers, those teams in a bigger picture beyond the marketing value too.
It's an interesting kind of cut across here to one of the questions we've got listed elsewhere. It knits nightly in from Saul Hymus, Fernando Alonso coming to the WEC created a lot of media attention and hype. It did. However, despite highly achieved IndyCar drivers like Seb Bourdais and Scott Dixon doing Le Mans, that Sol has not seen the same amount of hype around them. Is he not looking well enough? Is the comparative lack of hype real? If it's real, why do you think that's the case? Was there as much hype around Sebastian Loeb when he came to Le Mans? I think there's a difference in some instances, and I'd be grateful for your thoughts on particularly Scotty Dixon here. Seb Bourdais, massive following in the South region because he's local to Le Mans. Seb Loeb is an international superstar. There certainly was some hype there, but he wasn't necessarily in a high-profile car. Yes, he could have won it, and yes, he did very well in it, but effectively, he was somebody stepping over from a rally car, quite literally, as he did at the test day, flying in from WRC Rally into the seats in an LMP1 car and doing very, very well. I don't know. For me, you've got, I don't know, strata of stardom. When you've won not one but two Formula One World Championships, that is a different level to just about anything else out there. Whether or not you've won big races, whether or not you've won big championships, whether or not you've won multiple big races and big championships, just the sheer media force that gets behind Formula One, that does tend to kind of outscore everything. But I'd be interested in what you think, particularly around Scott Dixon.
I mean, good Lord. Dixon, as I have professed probably far too many times, yeah, I mean, this is an all-time great who's still in action. Profile, of course, which we know, lower because he's not in Formula One. I would say, a Sebastian Loeb. Anyone like a Loeb who's been engaged in an international championship, WRC, F1, you name it, at the highest level, multiple championships, is going to be better known and more highly regarded than someone like Dixon. But whether the world knows about it or not doesn't really influence whether someone is just truly and incredibly amazing. So I would say that, yeah, the amount of hype for Bourdais and for Dixon doing Le Mans, other than Seb, because he's a local, Seb's going to garner a massive amount of interest at his home event. But outside of that, I'm not exactly sure that folks in India are, jumping up and down because Sebastian Bourdais is competing at Le Mans or Scott Dixon. But naturally, someone like Alonso, who's just been at the highest register of awareness for two decades now. Yeah, just a natural. Granted, if you were to put Alonso, Bourdais, and Dixon in three equal cars and to tell them to go race against one another for a couple hours, I'm not necessarily putting Alonso in the lead at the end of it as an automatic response, just because I've seen what Dixon can do. I've seen what Bourdais can do as well. So, but yeah, three greats, just three different levels of international recognition. At the same time, Alonso, multiple world champion, there's been hype. He's driven for Ferrari, the most widely known and recognized racing team in the world. So, yeah. Anytime you're comparing folks against Fernando, you're going to be talking about someone in a big shadow. And even Loeb, when he was at his peak, there was a lot of buzz around that. But compared to Fernando, definitely a lesser amount.
Last couple of questions for the moment, at least, for this batch. They're both around LMP1 as it currently sits and LMP1 in the near future. One from Simon Fisher. Says about the growth of private P1 in WC, single-seater teams looking at sports car racing. Is there an argument to have P1 cars back in the ELMS to help provide a larger available market support the specialist manufacturers? Fair point. Come back to that one in a moment. Corey Schumacher, says last week we were talking about activation by a manufacturer. Doesn't see the difference between a global format with DPI formats versus car. Spending less on the car means more money to activate. Small manufacturers such as Koenigsegg can spend €20 million, 100% the budget goes to the car, 0% to activate. Also, by using existing chassis, allows someone like Aston or McLaren to compete with Ford, GM, etc. on a more level engineering platform. Doesn't see how spending more on the car makes better racing in the WEC. Please explain. First things first, Simon, no, I don't see there being the opportunity, certainly this side of any kind of major issues that might befall the WEC in future years, there being P1 cars back in the ELMS. That's because they've got a full grid. And in fact, talking now about potentially having to artificially restrict that grid, I think we're heading towards nearly 20 LMP2 cars next year. And if you've got the core ELMS cabal capable of filling that number, then I don't think they're going to play with the regulations. As for Corey's point, it's a fair point, but I think you've also got to see here, Corey, that there's a very big difference between the reasoning from a Toyota or a Ford to the reasoning of someone like, for the sake of arguing, you use Koenigsegg, we'll repeat that, or a Glickenhaus. The activation by those makers is by being there and by bringing the potential customers, which are a relatively small number, a relatively small number, to that track to watch that happen and to have the part of that experience. With a Toyota or a Ford or another major brand, it's about spreading the message, as Audi did brilliantly for season after season, about what their effort, their technology, their approach, they're pushing back their boundaries, could actually do in terms of transference to the road car. So it's not quite as simple as just that number. The number that is troubling the ACO about, still to this day, by the way, about Audi pulling out and Porsche pulling out, is not the fact that they've lost a, insert whichever number you care to say, 50, 100, 200, 500 million euros race program. What's bothering the ACO is the opportunity for those brands to bring that effort and its associated activation to further fill the coffers of the racing organization in the paddock, in terms of trackside advertising, in terms of other things that could actually fuel popularity of their product. That's the big deal here. It's not about whether or not you spend 20, 30, 40 million euros on a car. It's whether or not you've done that in a way that you've got the brand relevance that means those big brands will be present trackside. And by the way, if they are, 9 times out of 10, that's a pretty good thing for the people attending, because it's more an event, there's more behind it, there's more opportunity and more sustainability for somewhere beyond just a single event. So what they're trying to do with CarCar, with Hypercar, actually has got a great deal of common sense. Whether or not they can achieve it with the current rule set that they're discussing, whether or not there will be the right manufacturers coming forward to deliver that, we're going to know remarkably quickly now. I think we're going to start to hear a lot more about who definitely is coming and who definitely isn't coming. And at this point, there's a dotted line under that list. A lot of what you'll have seen and read elsewhere, I think you need to discount. A lot of what's going to be happening is going to be determined in the next few weeks and very few months as to who is going to be racing globally, who is going to be racing in Europe, who's going to be racing in North America, and who isn't going to be racing at all.
Hmm. Well, where shall we go next, my friend? And I'm about to say something that is often said in jest, but this is actually kind of sort of accurate. Got about 20 minutes to go. So
right. Well, I'll tell you what. Why don't we clear up a couple of our more personal ones, and then we'll finish this off with a little bit of I'll maybe pick up one of the SRO questions and finish off with a bit of an IMSA time. Would that work?
Whatever you like, mate. Whatever you like.
Let's go with Joseph Otroski's question. Just how good is Raffaele Marchiello? Very, very good, Joseph. Next question. From Donald Goran, Donald M. Goran. Gentlemen. Just gentleman. I think he's actually implying it's only you or I.
I think we know it's you.
Yeah, it's a fair point. Well made. What do you think the future holds for next season and beyond for Catherine Legg's career? Where she's signed on for Jaguar I-Pace, maybe MSR of the Acura GT3 program. She's taking a liking to NASCAR. What do you think? You're a little closer, I think, to Catherine on your side of the pond than I am.
She is held in incredibly high regard by Acura and Honda, Donald. So, provided the Meyer Shank IMSA GTD team continues forward with Acura, which I'm fairly confident is going to happen, it would be very strange to see Catherine not a part of that moving forward. I know that they are very keen on trying to expand their relationship with her, just because they believe very much in her talents. And she's also a really solid brand ambassador. The Jaguar I-Pace thing is great. The NASCAR thing as well. I think, Donald, Catherine's in an interesting place where she had a career. It was going in a direction. She's had to make adjustments multiple times. She was with Donald Don Painos's Delta Wing effort for a couple of years, was a big part of that. Then has picked up this Acura gig. I hope she is seeing that with the amount of inquiries coming in that would allow her now to race an Acura and vie for a GTD championship, to go do this new I-Pace trophy thing with some of the things she's been doing in NASCAR and the Xfinity series. I hope she just starts pushing harder to embrace the diversity of what's coming in. One of the things that drivers so often do, it's not a criticism, it's just an acknowledgement, is they try and make one thing work and they cling to it super hard, Graham. And I'm going to be this and do this in this series and that's it. Sometimes that works, sometimes it doesn't. I think what we're seeing with Catherine is folks saying, hey, come play with us, come play over here. And if she's willing to push that one series, one team, one goal mindset to the side a little bit, I think her career could head into some really fun and new and ongoing and interesting places. So that's what I hope her future holds, Donald. And it just takes her continuing to embrace the additional inquiries coming in there. Let's see. Let's take one here from our friend Shay Adam. It says, the powers that be have bestowed upon you a magical gift. You may select any driver who is currently silver to remain that rating for the rest of their life, no matter what they accomplish, with a guaranteed ride. Here's the catch. You must pick three silvers to compete in a go-kart race, and the winner gets the honor. Who are your three silvers, and that you'd like?
This is three current silvers.
I believe so. Who are the three silvers that you'd most like to help? So the winner of that three-silver kart race gets to remain a silver for the rest of their life. If only I had the FIA ratings list in front of me. It sure would be a lot easier to answer that question.
Well, you've just mentioned, surely, is Catherine still a silver?
Probably. I can actually access that somewhat.
Well, I mean, that being the case.
Yes, she's a silver. Spencer, let me just read a couple, just so we have a few, and I realize this is IMSA that I'm staring at, but I'm looking at the Petit Le Mans entry list. Daniel Murad is a silver, Sheldon Vanderlinde, Lucas Stoltz, Andrew Davis, Madison Snow, Christina Nielsen, Cooper McNeil, Gunnar Jeanette, Frankie Montecalvo, I'm just trying to pick a few others, Spencer Pompelli, Catherine, obviously, Justin Marks, Mario Farnbacher, boy, isn't he super. Let's see, just I'll try and grab a few other quick ones here. Sean Rahal, Kyle Marcelli.
Let me just chuck this into the mix for this one for you, MP, which is by making them a permanent silver, it increases their chances of gainful employment. And on that basis, I'm going to give you the first two. You've mentioned both of them because actually we could do with a little bit of rebalancing out there. Certainly Catherine, and I'm going to say Christina as well, because what we want are talented female drivers that are going to spread the word worldwide that they are capable of competing head to head with the best of the rest of us, certainly far better than I am. And I think that would be a good thing. Beyond that, I'll add you one in, from someone I don't believe should be a silver anymore, but he currently is. So let's give it a whirl. That's Andrea Pizzitola. I firmly believe that Andrea is going to be a gold next year. I know there's lots and lots and lots of drivers formerly a not all that orderly queue looking to take up the possibility of filling in for Andrea's current, you know, winning form. He's the now reigning LMS champion way before we get to the end of the year. So the likes of Andrea Pizzitola, I think, would be a good one as well. You've got lots of other up-and-coming, very talented young men, including the likes of Jurgen van Utert. You may or may not be seeing more of Jurgen van Utert.
I couldn't even spell. I wouldn't know what letter to start that name with. So
Get used to it. You might be seeing him elsewhere when we get into 2019. He's going to be certainly an LMP2 on this side of the pond. And I think he's having a bit of a sniff around the opportunities that he has, might well be a second season silver. Jurgen Utert, 19-year-old guy from the Netherlands, who's very quick indeed. And I think we might actually be looking for him to have a parallel North American program too. So let's wait and see. You know, it's a great question, and it recognises, as you would imagine that Shay would, the advantages to young and sometimes not so young professional drivers of being, you know, a silver-ranked driver. I always quote, and I'll quote it again, when people ask, what difference does it make? The example that goes back a few years, maybe a decade or so, to the RML team in the Le Mans Series and then the European Le Mans Series, Tommy Erdos. Fabulous race driver, and his, I've just, you know what, completely forgotten his surname. Ben from Ben became the Stig, Ben Collins.
Yeah.
Ben Collins, sorry, Ben. They raced together in the MG Lolas with Mike Newton, were broadly similar in terms of pace in whatever condition. Then Ben went off and did what he did. He worked with the BBC as the Stig. He went off and forged a fantastic career in filmmaking, principally with the James Bond franchise, and didn't race for a couple of years. So he came back and he was a silver. Tommy struggled on through with his racing career and remained a gold. Ben came back and got WC drives, LMS drives, Le Mans 24 Hours drives. He had raced a few of the races in IMSA. And Tommy didn't. And Tommy, as a gold-ranked driver, of broadly the same ability, simply lost his opportunity to retain the career. That's what it means in terms of the potential for a driver to have, extend, and profit from a professional race driver career. Smart question, Shay Adam.
Absolutely. All right, let's grab a few more in the general category here, and maybe we'll just bounce around a little bit to close. Alex Eichmiller says, last week you mentioned the unfortunate loss of Graham's impressive coloring book library. What are your must-read motorsports books? Alex, I'll throw a few in, and that's because I'm just wheeling my chair to the right to stare at some obnoxious bookshelves filled with motor racing titles. I will pick first, and it's one that it continues to be an amazing read. That would be, I believe his first name is Gerald Donaldson's book on Gilles Villeneuve. It's just titled Villeneuve. That one, boy, just truly, truly amazing piece of writing by Mr. Donaldson. And I'll pick two others. Vic Elford's autobiography. It's Vic Elford. He's just the best. You would be a smart person to pick up good old Vic's autobiography. And after that, let's see. Boy, there's a lot here that I'm staring at, and many of these are covered. Something that is a little bit newer, possibly. I would say Art Garner's book, Black Noon, about the tragedy in the early 60s at the Indianapolis 500. I believe it was 62 or 63. That is just, it's a sad, but also a really compelling and thrilling read. And if you can, maybe I'll throw in one more. If you want to go back in time, and you can probably find this maybe on eBay or in a memorabilia store, Jim Clark's book, Jim Clark at the Wheel. That was, I believe, the first motor racing book I ever read. That was given to me by my grandfather, and still have it, staring at it. No dust jacket, but wow. My dad loved Jim Clark more than any other, and reading that just amplified my love for my father's all-time racing hero, Jim Clark. What about you, Graham?
It's an interesting one, isn't it? Most of the books I tend to kind of read and use, for that matter, tend to be the kind of yearbook and historic examples. And there's some great examples of that, great books about the history of the Nürburgring 24 Hours, for instance, the history of the Spa 24 Hours, the history of the Daytona 24 Hours. I have a stack of books on my shelves that I've not yet got round to reading. The Brian Redman book, not yet got round to reading that. There's a fantastic Desiree Wilson book. I've not got round to finishing that yet. The one, though, that I did most recently finally get off the stack and read properly, which I have to say I do recommend, is Michael Kaiser's French Kiss with Death, which is about Steve McQueen and the Le Mans movie. Just a great book. Just really, really beautifully illustrated. It's a film I still hold dear. I will still, you know, given half an opportunity to sit down and watch that thing from beginning to end. And it, you know, it's a dreadful script, but it doesn't matter. The visuals are just absolutely world-beating, stunning, stunning piece of movie making, and I recommend that one.
Beautiful. All right, let's see. Let's grab a couple of others here. All right, here's a fun one, and I genuinely don't know your answer to this. This comes in from Reddit and Opposite Lock. What non-racing related podcasts do you guys listen to?
Here's the rub.
You keep talking about rubs.
Yeah.
And you're just back from Cyprus.
Oh, indeed.
I'm concerned.
The reality is, we shared a little bit about MP's personal life and the awful circumstances earlier in the show. I have a very busy life outside what I do with Daily Sports Car and with the Weekend Sports Cars. MP and people closest to me know that I have two children, one son in his 30s, one daughter in her teens. And I would just say that our daughter doesn't live with us at the moment. Her health problems prevent that from happening, but that does keep myself and Trudy extraordinarily busy. And the honest answer is, I genuinely don't find the time to do much more in terms of the other areas of interest as much as I'd like. That said, I am becoming a bit smarter about the way in which I consume all sorts of media. Massive change in the way in which I watch TV in the last 2 or 3 months, and massively impressed with the scales have fallen from my eyes, having dumped our cable TV package and gone for something else completely different. And you know what? This is a world, I think, as next year's racing calendar comes into full focus, and I'll be traveling a lot more again than I am this year with the WC getting back up to a full calendar speed. I suspect that's something that I will be becoming a lot more interested in listening, reading, etc., in some of the limited free time I have while staring at the back of someone else's seat. Because after 3 intercontinental trips, you've generally tend to see all the movies. So I'll ask you this. Drop us a line. Drop me a line. Let me know what's good out there. Let me know what you think would be of interest to a man of my limited time and availability. But the honest answer at the moment is, genuinely, there are very few podcasts indeed that I listen to, even within racing, let alone outside it. And, you know, generally speaking, MP, you bring forward a project like the Weekend IndyCar and the Weekend Sports Cars for 2 reasons. 1, you're passionate about it. 2, you believe that actually no one else is actually covering that as well as it should be. I hope we're filling a gap.
Yeah, I mean, there are folks who've been doing this a lot longer than us, and who I'm sure will come into the game and do a far better job, and are currently doing better jobs than us. I just know that this is a passion point for you and I.
Oh, yeah.
And since this is the only place you're going to hear Marshall and Graham talking about sports cars, and this seems like the good place to do it. I'll just throw in quickly, Monsieur or Madame opposite Locke, non-racing, Bill Simmons podcast I listen to when I can. Big fan of Simmons, have been for at least 15 years or so. Love the Combat Jack show. That's really no longer, unfortunately. The host died earlier this year, but just an amazing show. Someone who's been a hip-hop insider since seemingly day one, and just the conversations with all the folks in the industry, a lot of the folks from the golden era that made hip-hop what it is. I listen to the Combat Jack episode slowly because I don't want to exhaust a finite number to enjoy. Let's see, what else? Joe Rogan I used to listen to very, very frequently. I don't listen as often. Joe's kind of ventured into way too much about marijuana and just a little bit off track, so a little bit less of interesting conversations and more personal agendas pushed on a regular basis about drugs or this or that or the other. So that stuff I get a little bit bored with. But probably the most enduring one that I listen to is Mark Maron's WTF podcast, and have listened to that for I don't know how long. But those are the ones that I enjoy, tend to be longer conversational type formats instead of the shorter, faster, cover a million topics in 0 seconds kind of thing. And also enjoyed Aisha Tyler's Girl on Guy podcast, but that is not something that she has been really updating much for a while now, so that's a little bit of a legacy show. So those are the ones that are non-racing that I tend to enjoy. If there are any that you all enjoy that, as Graham mentioned, you think we might dig, let us know. We'll check it out because we're simple like that. Let's see. Couple more, Graham. Why don't you steer us towards a couple more, and then we will bid farewell to this week's episode.
Well, oddly enough, we started with a question about the new Porsche 935. Graham Ingleby has asked a question. I think it's a repeat one from Graham. We've seen it before, and we've not got to it. All the travel required in this series. Has anyone ever lost a car, had a car damaged in transit? I can imagine an angry team owner at the lost luggage desk describing their... Yes, you can imagine, can't you? A couple of quick stories, one of which was to do with the... currently called the China Endurance Series last year, the FRD LMP3 series, where all sorts of issues with getting those cars through the labyrinthine Chinese customs process did mean that they didn't actually have all their cars they had in the country at the track by the time the championship started. That was got over. The one, though, that I mentioned, the 935, that I remember is there was a one-off GT festival at the time in Bahrain back in 2004, and I was there the day that the containers arrived and they took the cars out. And there was a Porsche 935, mercifully not an original car, that came out rather more short-nosed and short-tailed than it had actually been dispatched. And, yeah, long faces, there most certainly were. There will be a myriad of those kind of descriptions. International travel, you cannot pack these things in cotton wool. And I'm sure, MP, there'd be rather, there'd been a very large number down through the years of cars that arrived not exactly in showroom condition. That's that one from me. The other one, Jonathan Wesley, this is another one, by the way, MP, that certainly has been doing the rounds for a couple of weeks. And apologies, guys, we're just not finding that time to get through all these. Do either of you have a favourite Golf livery, whether or not it won't be in the original 60s, 70s iterations? A more recent example, you must have seen a few this past weekend, MP. Mine would be one of the many variations of stripes, arrows, Acer clubs, covered Porsche 908s, and the Tarkle Florios of the early 70s, just not sure which one. Do you want to have a crack at that?
Yeah, I will admit to have really loved and dug the blue and orange livery for many years. I think I've just fallen out of love a little bit. Maybe it's just lost interest to me. I know that if I'm thinking perfect colors in that Golf theme, The 75, I believe, Mirage GR, would have been a 7 or 8, the Le Mans winning entry of Derek Bell and Jackie Ickx, owned by my pal, or I guess run by my pal, Harley Cluxton. Having been up close to that one, the colors just seem particularly spot on. So, I guess maybe that's my answer. But, yeah, I mean, I saw plenty of 917s and such beautifully dressed in their Gulf liveries last weekend. And while they look perfect in position on those cars, yeah, just not something that at least my eyes fancy as much as they once did.
I get the point. I think that to make something iconic, it's got to be very good to start with, hasn't it? And certainly the Ford GT40s, the Mirages, the 917s did exactly that. For me, maybe a surprising answer here, which is it's a rather more, those aside, they're iconic. In terms of a nod towards that, actually, the long-term McLarens I particularly liked. Mm. What it wasn't was the same thing adapted to a different body shape. It was more than a nod towards it, of course, but I just thought there were design elements put into those cars that just lifted them more than perhaps some of the more recent stuff has. And I'll give you one further exception, which is the current Gulf Racing Porsche in the WEC and the other car in the LMS that has been around for two or three races this year. Again, they've put design elements in that that have been specifically designed around the car that it sits upon, which does lift it. And that does make a difference. They're the two for me. You want to bring us home with a bit of SRO world, or are we about done?
Yes, we should pick something from the SRO world. Why? How could we possibly complete an episode without some form of mention of Stefan Rattel? Let's see. Which one of these jumps out to you? We've got Buddy Campbell, well, Ryan Casillas, Chris Avelsby, whose last name I'm never going to process correctly, and our pal, Right Turn Lover.
We'll try and cover the whole lot in one. Buddy Campbell. Yes, Buddy Campbell says Stefan Rattel used to be seen as like the savior of GT racing. The more he takes over, I think he's a Bond villain. Hell bends on world domination through GTM racing. Does this endless announcement of new series worry you? There might be a GT racing bubble that's going to burst. Ryan, Brenner Wheel Challenge is no more. SRO finally amalgamated the once colorful and unique series into the Blancpain GT World Challenge America. Doesn't that just roll off the tongue, he says. Do you guys think that will grow the series or maybe bring in more European entrants? Will the grids continue to shrink? Will there be enough demand to meet supply of four GT4 championships? How will TC classes fit in? Chris says, do you think the new Black Blancpain got us thing that could be a series beginning in a few years that almost relaunches the Pirelli World Challenge aspect? All three Continental Series have world in them. Will there be a grand final almost like Super Trofeo? I'll start with this for what will be a catch-all answer. He was the saviour of GT racing, together with his colleagues Patrick Peter, Jürgen Barth. There's no doubt about it that back in the day, mid-90s, Stefan Rattel was the saviour not only of the GT racing, but also the Le Mans 24 Hours. That's all too easily forgotten. The pantomime villain side of things, I think, comes with the fact that what Stefan has got now is a format that works for his business. He builds up the grids. That's why GT3 has worked for him. GT4 is working for him. He hopes GT2 will work for him. And with that comes a degree of templating, I'd call it here, which I know does not fit well with a lot of people. You know, I've been to races in the SRO's world that I thought were really excellent. I've been to races, and I said it before here, that the current way in which the Spa 24 Hours works just does not appeal to me at all. We've got to the stage where GT3 regulations and now GT4 have got enough variety so that actually you've got a different soundtrack and there's some great, great visuals. But sometimes for me, the racing with balanced performance being in place is not of the best. Sometimes it does work. So I understand why people would be worried about the effect it's having on their particular favoured championship, and absolutely understand why people who love the Pirelli World Challenge would be worried about that. As to whether or not that will lead to some kind of breakaway eventually, I think that's going to depend on whether or not the plans they now have moving forward are successful. I would say that I absolutely agree that the Pirelli World Challenge needed a work over in terms of the level of professionalism with the way that things are run. There's a lot of very easy hits that could make a fundamental difference with the ease of being able to follow, understand, and buy into the consistency of that product moving forward. As for whether or not the racing will be better, that will come in the space of time. MP.
Yeah. So I believe that Stefan Rattel suffers from the same thing that we had a little bit of fun with last week, or a lot of fun last week, with Zach Brown. Lots of ideas, high ambition, can see so many possibilities. Let's do them all. Let's maybe do them all at once. We're going to try a million things. And they don't all necessarily come to fruition. They do not all necessarily manifest. I would say that with Stefan, definitely not a villain, just has a particular vision, and boy, is he determined to carry that forward. With what I'm staring at coming here, visited upon my my beloved World Challenge Series, Graham, yeah, I have concerns. I have big concerns that it is too much variety, even more variety. The series suffered from too much variety to begin with. We're going to continue in that direction. We've also done the thing where we've gone from it being something regarded as a pro place to really a pro-am environment. Customer racing, the paddock is now the number one voice. And yeah, my fear, which maybe speaks to Buddy's question and Ryan's question, I fear that Stefan does not grasp North America and why our approach to racing has, by and large, been different than almost every other region in the world. Not better or worse, just very different. And I think this is just going to benefit IMSA. And that's, we don't need to have a situation where we have two separate sports car championships with one on the up and one on the down. We could have two that are doing well. I just think at least North American sensibilities, we're going to see more people say, okay, so you're kind of sort of an endurance series now, maybe a little bit. What? Huh? If I'm going to do endurance, let me really do endurance. So, yes, I can tell you this, and I don't want to close on a down, but I am very concerned about where the series is headed. If by chance they can drum up enough business internally from their paddock, from the manufacturers that want to stay involved, then okay, they can do their thing. Who cares what I think or anyone else thinks, Graham? They're funding it. They're doing it. The rest of the world be damned. I just know that if I look at some of the folks wanting to jump out of TCR, for example, and move over to IMSA in the what's going to become the Michelin tire series once Continental leaves. I fear that as time goes on, this Rattel SRO Blanc panification is going to be the wrong thing for how Americans tend to look at their sports car racing. So don't want to be wrong. I fear that I might be.
Well, there you go. It's a good place as any to finish this one, MP. It's going to be another quick fire one, I think, next week, because I will be on my toes, and I think we're probably going to have to record this whilst I'm sitting in a lounge in Hong Kong on the way down to Fuji.
Yeah, and I've got, we have a lot of appointments and visit, doctor's visits and that kind of stuff. So, yeah, we are going to have to find some time to do this on the fly. And also,
but remember,
keep in mind that we've got Petit Le Mans coming up, and you've obviously
absolutely
got WEC. So, we're going to do our best. We're going to do our best, and hopefully it doesn't end up being our worst.
It won't be that. No, we've had far worse than that, mate. Don't you worry. There'll be more worse to come, I'm sure, in the future. So from me, it's good night from here in the UK. And again, before we close, all my very best to you and yours, MP. I'm sure absolutely everybody's thoughts are with you. And there'll be happier days ahead.
Thank you, my friend. Thanks to everyone for their kind words, kind notes, and support. Whew, IMSA season's almost over. WC sure isn't. I don't know. What are we at? Are we even at the halfway point? I don't know where we're at, man. You know, that must be depressing. Good Lord.
Well, we know we're near halfway. Yes.
Okay.
Whether or not it's in race numbers or indeed in track time, we've still got another Le Mans 24 hours to come, and of course, a longer race to come at Sebring in March, but lots of action still to go.
Well, rumors that IMSA is going to announce Appetit Le Mans, going to more than one up the FIWC in the Super Season. Rumors they're going to announce IMSA's Super Decade. So, ooh. Yes, a full decade, one championship, a decade long. Thankfully, no, I'm just kidding. I just pulled that on my butt. All right, let's bid farewell. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to Cooper Tires for supporting what we do. And we don't know where we're going to be, but we're going to speak to you next week from a lounge, from an office, from a something, and continue our little week in sports cars fun.